Veterans and Emergency Preparedness is now in session. We have a quorum present. We have one excused member. Representative Boone is currently out with an excusable family issue that we wish well and that look forward to her returning soon. Representative Parrish will join us when she can. We're going to do something every meeting that hopefully reminds everybody that is involved in the process why we're here. Every week that we are still at war, people are putting their lives on the line. And before we get to the committee business today, before we get to introductions and the interesting reports that I'm looking forward to hearing, we're going to put first things first. So I'm going to read a little bit about somebody who gave everything he had to give this past week, and then we're going to have a moment of silence. In recognition of William Ryan Owens, on Sunday, January 29th, 2017, Chief Special Warfare Operator William Ryan Owens, 36 years old, from Peoria, Illinois, was killed in action during a raid in Yemen against senior al-Qaeda leadership. He was a member of the Navy's elite SEAL Team 6. Secretary of Defense James Mattis commented that Ryan gave his full measure for our nation, and in performing his duty, he upheld the noblest standard of military service. All of us in this room, especially folks that are here to talk about veterans care, veteran services, we all have a connection. And we know that every time we go out and do the job that we're called upon to do or used to be called upon to do, the ultimate sacrifice was always an option. So for the next 30 seconds to a minute, we're going to have a moment of silence thinking about the folks that are still in harm's way so that we can be here today talking about important things for our state. All right, thank you. All right, this is the 2017 House Veterans and Emergency Preparedness Committee. Before we get to rules, what I'd like to do is a brief introduction of the members, starting with my, to the right, Mr. Post, if you could introduce yourself.
Well, hi, Bill Post, House District 25, Kaiser, St. Paul, and Newburgh, and this is pretty dang exciting to be here. It really is. I mean, to be involved with anything to do with veterans, of which some of y'all are here, and I really appreciate it, and especially you guys are here, too. So this is a big honor, a big privilege, and I really appreciate it. I'm looking forward to this.
Thank you. I'm John Lively. I'm House District 12, which is Springfield. I'm an Army vet, and so is my father, who's 92 years old, and I'm overseeing his care. He's a World War II veteran, and I still enjoy talking about the war and the role that he played and so many other people did. So I'm honored to serve on this committee also.
Good afternoon. Mark Meek from House District 40, which is Oregon City Gladstone, and I'm proud that I served 8 years active duty in United States Air Force and was actually part of the Cold War, even though it wasn't combat. Securing our missile first line of defense, capabilities in Montana. And my dad served 2 terms in Vietnam and as a Marine. And so the veterans have been very near and dear to my heart all my life. And I'm very proud to serve on this committee also. So I'm looking forward to doing some good work. Thank you.
So I'm Julie Parrish. I am the state rep from House District 37, which is Westland and Tualatin. I have kind of jokingly told folks this is the only committee I've never been kicked off on, so this is my 4th term of Veterans Affairs. And it's the one I've continuously been on. How's that? As I've moved off and on other committees, this one I have managed to stay on, which is a good thing because my husband is a retired Army colonel, did 2 tours in Iraq. My brother was in the Army. My brother-in-law is in the Navy. We still keep him and let him come to family dinners. I just, in the last little winter snowstorm, took my nephew to MEPS. He's now at basic training. training. So we've got yet another person from our family who is military. And while my father was not in the military, he spent 18 months in Iraq attached to the military as a translator post 9/11. So we are very much committed to making sure that veterans have full funding, that we have programs and services that work. And so I'm very pleased to be back on this committee with people who I know care about this. And the one thing that is great about this is that on our first day of school, you are all out there in the audience, and that this room is full. We want to keep it full all through the session and keep the pressure on for making sure we do the right thing. But I trust that everybody on this committee knows how to do the right thing, because we've done it for the last 6 years since I've been here, and longer since Sal's been here. So I just appreciate you being here, and I'm looking forward to the discussions this year.
Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6, Medford. Probably myself and Senator Boquist are the longest standing people in the veterans committees. I am a Vietnam veteran, a Vietnam combat veteran. I joined the Navy, never was on board a ship, but I got to spend a whole year in country, anywhere from Da Nang clear down to Canto Bintui, Long Xuyen area. I was the supply liaison for all naval and marine aviation activities in country and comp for WestPAC Atsugi Japan to control those activities.
So, say that five times fast. Pardon? Say that five times fast.
I can. I practiced a long time to say that. I'm also working with the Southern Oregon Veterans Benefit Program to put a replica, 80% replica of the Vietnam Wall in Medford, Oregon. It'll be about $500,000, so we will continue on that basis. We've got a spot. We've already acquired a spot for it, so we're up and running. We're ready to go on it, so we're just about $250,000 short of our goal, but we'll make it. And I'm a lifetime member of the VFW. I'm a lifetime member of the NCOs. I'm a lifetime member of the American Legion. Now, let's see, what else do I belong to? But I'm very much, very much emotional about, if we're going to send our kids in harm's way, then by God, we could take care of them when they come home. And, you know, being in the Vietnam era, and I'm sure a lot of you were in Vietnam. We weren't supported in the field. We weren't supported by our government. We weren't supported by the people. And some of us were treated pretty bad when we came home. So, for that, I welcome you home, soldiers.
Thank you. I also want our staff to introduce themselves, because you're going to be working with the staff throughout the session. They're going to be making sure that I keep the train on time.
Thank you, Chair. Bradley Volk. I'm one of the committee analysts for the Veterans Affairs Emergency Preparedness. My background, I'm an attorney. I've been in the active duty in Air Force Reserves, and I'm very happy to see so many veterans out in the audience. It's quite an honor.
Good afternoon. My name is Sky Kubret. I'm your committee assistant. This is my first opportunity to be here sitting on a committee with you and facilitating and supporting you, so thank you so much for your hard work. I, too, am directly connected to the military in a few different ways, but I recently went through MEPS myself looking for a scholarship to go to medical school, so maybe I'll be joining the ranks. Thank you.
Okay. I'm Paul Evans. I represent House District 20. I'm the chair. I'm grateful to be surrounded by the Navy and the Air Force and a potential doctor. That's going to be very helpful. I represent West Salem, South Salem, Monmouth Independence, and very excited about this committee. A couple of quick housekeeping things so that we get the ball rolling the appropriate way, and then we'll move to discussion and adoption of committee rules. You notice a little bit, but one of the things that we're going to be using from time to time is the sand glass. It's a 20-minute sand glass. Today we actually have a pretty loose schedule, so we don't need to use it. But I want to make sure people understand in the future, if there's a lot of people talking, we're going to be using this as a subtle reminder the time we have to be moving ahead. The other thing is, and it was posted today and available for you, is a letter as well as a one-pager for military folks. You love the one-pagers. That basically, if you're somebody who's going to be testifying here a lot, and I hope you will be, it basically is a, I would say, an Air Force-proof approach to being able to share your ideas and opinions. The reason this is helpful is often when someone comes in and starts testifying, lots of questions get asked, and they never actually have an opportunity to get the two, three, or four main points they'd like to get across. And since we live in the 21st century, and you can actually have this and be up in front of us talking, I highly recommend anybody who's going to be testifying from time to time to be using this tool. It's a template. I want to emphasize that our job as a committee, especially in the times that we live in, is focused on veterans and emergency preparedness. To the greatest extent possible, Thursdays are going to be focused on veterans policy. Tuesdays are going to be focused on emergency preparedness and resiliency. The reason for that is some of you actually have to be testifying before the Senate committee and the House committee, and they're at the same time. So to try to deconflict things, we're trying to make it as simple as possible. Another thing is our job is to manage the work assigned to us, but to the greatest extent possible, most of the things that we do in this committee, with veterans and emergency preparedness specifically, the state isn't the only actor in. We have a role to facilitate conversations, to make sure that federal policy, state, and local policy is aligned in providing the services that are necessary. So to the greatest extent we can, we're going to try to use this as a learning opportunity for people to come forward, share ideas, talk about what's going on. The members have been encouraged to identify benchmark programs, either in veterans or emergency preparedness, to bring into the committee. Also, before the committee got together, so we didn't violate any rules, we weren't quite in the 2017 session yet, I listed out a number of work groups that I'd like you to consider leading. These work groups will be very focused on not legislation for this session, but hopefully preparing the ground for the future. When it comes to emergency preparedness, we literally have a 317-year clock rolling, and we're over time for a large seismic event. So we will have a work group on ARES, amateur radio structures and systems. We'll have a work group on Citizen Corps and credentialing, which is going to be very critical when we actually have the federal government come in and assist. We're going to have a work group on existing potential training synergies with DPSST. We're going to have a work group on airports. We're going to have a work group on seaports. We're going to work group on scalable response and recovery facilities. I hope to also have a work group on critical ground routes that former Chair Lively is going to be leading for us, as well as 911 status, technology horizons, and local government training. These work groups will not be done, for the most part, during our regularly scheduled times, although from time to time work groups may report. The staff, Bradley and Sky work very hard, but they can't support all of those things, so I've actually called in volunteers to assist. Those of you familiar with Steve Anderson, he's going to be assisting with this like he did last time with the Lend-Lease bill and some others. I believe we have a lot of work to do over the next 6 months and not a lot of time to do it. And with your help, we're going to be able, I think, to make some real progress. Before I get to the rules, I want to say thank you again for being here. I noticed the brown hats out there representing VFW, and the smiles of the folks that aren't wearing a brown hat, one Marine in particular who could have worn a hat but didn't. It is critical over the next 6 months that veterans' voice be involved in not just the issue I suggest that you're probably here today to talk about, budget issues, but also in the carry-through, making sure the government is as effective as possible in addition to being efficient. So thank you for being here. So with that said, to start the committee formally, we have to have rules to run the meeting, and I am entertaining a motion to accept the rules that are the model rules to be used in the committee.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the proposed rules for the House Committee of Veteran Affairs Emergency Preparedness dated today, February 2nd, 2017.
There is a motion on the floor to adopt the rules. Is there any discussion? Okay. Seeing no discussion, I ask that a roll call be called.
Representative Lively.
Aye.
Representative Meek.
Aye.
Representative Farish.
Aye.
Representative Post.
Aye.
Vice Chair Booth.
Excused.
Vice Chair Esquivel.
Aye.
Chair Evans.
Aye. We now have rules, which is a good place to start. All right. Yes. The rules are adopted at this time. Mr. Smith, would you like to start us with the panel, please?
Chair, while he's coming up, can I just ask you one quick question about your work groups?
Sure.
So these work groups include, are they include but not limited to? And I guess the
yes.
one thing that I'm looking for is actually on recovery of government records. Mm. So where I'm not sure where that fits in here, but...
We can certainly add that as a work group.
Something kind of nerdy that I'm very interested in is how do we, you know, scan, document, and mm-hmm. redundantly store outside of our state the records of our government.
I think that could be either added to a work group or put to your credentialing side, because maintaining those records would be a logical extension.
Okay, thanks.
So thank you. Mr. Smith?
Good afternoon, Chair Evans, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Cameron Smith, the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And first, welcome back. And I want to first start by thanking our outgoing chair, Representative Lively, for all of his support over his tenure. And we are glad to still have you on the committee. I'm certainly excited to have Rep. Evans coming in as chair. But I did notice a trend as the introductions were being made. Chair Representative Evans is a proud Air Force veteran, Air National Guard. Representative Post did not reveal that his father was a U.S. Air Force veteran, and Rep. Post was actually born on Luke Air Force Base in Arizona. Our newest member, Representative Meek, an Air Force veteran, the staff, Bradley, Air Force Reserves.
That's right.
And Sky did not admit, but the committee assistant is hoping to join the Air Force. So we are thinking of referring this matter to the Speaker of the House as a bias of our new chair. But I simply
Shocked.
Have one question.
Shocked that you noticed such a thing.
For all of those associated with the Air Force here today, are you comfortable? Is it too hot? Is it too cold? We'll have
Pretty
facilities
good.
For
feels,
the Capitol yeah. On it in a second.
My chair was a little squeaky in there.
Now that I have nullified any support for ODBA's initiatives from any of our Air Force veterans here, we took the liberty of making our one-pager a two-pager, so we stretched it a little bit, but we will keep our remarks here short and sweet, given the other great testimony from partners here, and that you will often have us available for testimony. But any success that we have as a department at the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs is because of who we serve as a constituency and as a population and as a community. So we always start first and foremost with those four generations of veterans across five major wars, from World War II to today, an incredible citizen group that we serve and are proud to honor with all of our work through our leadership, our advocacy, and our core partnerships. We are that advocate in the corner of our veterans and their family as they seek to access their earned benefits, whether those are with the federal VA or whether those are with community partners. And we are proud of our core programs, and we'll have plenty of time to dive into those this session and through the budget. But our home loan program since 1945, our two skilled nursing facilities, one in Lebanon and one in the Dalles, beloved by the veterans community, our conservatorship program for vulnerable veterans to help manage their finances, and our core veteran services that most folks are familiar with as that advocate seeking those disability claims or health care benefits from the federal VA, often in partnership with the county veteran service officers or the service officers with the national service organizations. And while we are proud of those core programs, we know that serving and honoring veterans and making sure that their needs and outcomes are met for health care, education, and economic opportunity is a much broader mission than just our department. So we're thankful for those strong partnerships, specifically with the counties. We have had that veteran service relationship since 1945 together. Our partners with the federal VA, the big behemoth with the benefits, our tribal partners, our fellow state agencies that you'll hear from today, whether Department of Corrections and our work serving incarcerated veterans, our new director, Margaret 2.0, on Oregon Housing and Community Services, for all of our work on homeless veterans, making sure affordable housing is available for our veterans. And a special thank you to our community partners, very specifically our national service organizations. It feels like a VFW midwinter convention here today. And we have the engagement of our veterans, our national service organization partners. There is a united voice for our veterans across the state. And overarching, for that landscape of our veterans community, we have 326,000 veterans across the state. One out of every 12 Oregonians is a veteran, approximately 72,000, over 72,000 disabled veterans, and approximately 3 out of every 10 Oregon veterans have accessed what are largely their federal VA benefits. So a lot of room to do more outreach and still further connect, whether it's to Vietnam veterans or our most recently returned veterans. But just off of those federal benefit dollars, we titled this our two-pager, The Engine of Economic Opportunity. $2.6 billion total VA benefits on an annual basis. Half of that, $1.3 billion, is cash going into the bank accounts and wallets of our veterans across the state. Works out to be over $106 million a month flowing back into Oregon just on cash benefits, much less the significant health care benefits and the education benefits. And when you compare just going back to 2003 when 9/11 generation was first getting going, and the most recent conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan and around the world, almost 3 times increase in federal spending for veterans back here in Oregon. Across all of those, but now up to $2.6 billion. That work is not necessarily automatic and takes that advocacy, being in the corner of the veterans with our county VSOs and our NSO partners. Just across our power of attorney claims, new claims have doubled from 2013 from 6,000 to over 12,000. And while that graph on compensation and pension from the federal VA doesn't look a huge change, it is $1.1 billion to $1.3 billion. So off of all of those new claims that the counties are submitting up through ODVA, $200 million extra going to Oregon veterans every year, $400 million a biennium, that is significantly making their lives and their family lives better and making them thrive, but also being spent throughout our community with a significant economic impact. Our little icon there with the Oregon map. Just on population base, most of our veterans, like all of our citizens, live in the major metro areas and in the larger counties. But when you get out to rural Oregon, a quarter to a third of the veteran or a third of the population will often be veterans and their families. And while the raw dollars, you know, will be over $100 million in a Multnomah, a Lane, Washington County, $100 million of disability compensation flowing in every year. But when you get out to rural Oregon on a per capita basis, they often have done the outreach and are more deeply connected and have a higher per capita comp and pen in rural Oregon. So it really, that urban and rural are both urban on the raw numbers and then rural on that per capita number, significantly doing well by veterans. But we know, for as well as we are doing, we still are leaving resources on the table, and we most often compare ourselves. We are the rough population of Oklahoma veterans, but they've gone out and further done outreach and connected to more and gotten service connected to more disabled veterans and are drawing down $500 million extra every year for their veterans. So we know there are more veterans out there. They're not more disabled than we are, and we know we can go out and find them and get them connected to the benefits they have earned. On the flip side, through all of your leadership, last session, in the short session in 2016, the major veterans legislation was that House Joint Resolution 202 that all of you advocated for, was bipartisan and unanimous to embed 1.5% of net lottery revenues into the Constitution as a dedication to better serve veterans and their families. Again, unanimous and bipartisan out of the legislature, because it was broadly, you know, because of who we serve, our veterans and their families, but it wasn't solely envisioned to the benefit of ODVA's budget as much as where can these resources do the best throughout the state and in the community to better serve veterans. And knowing how, if we're spending $2.6 billion of federal VA resources, we know $18 million on a biennial basis isn't going to solve the world. But trying to find those points of leverage where we can better identify veterans, increase that drawdown of federal resources, leverage those community partnerships, and align funding for the long term. House Joint Resolution 202 became Measure 96 on the November general election ballot. And a historic 84% of Oregonians approved of that measure, with very little other than from the veterans community advocacy, not a lot of TV, radio, print ads, but 84% of Oregonians united behind that measure. So much of the discussion in this 2017 session will be around the budget. Obviously, both in the governor's recommended budget, in the co-chair's framework for many policy areas and focus areas, it's a difficult budget with a budget hole. But for the veterans, given that impact and support both of the legislature and citizens, it's one of the few bright spots that we do have more resources available to better serve veterans. When you look at the bottom of the chart for our overarching budget, we're about, in this biennium, about $92 million operational funds. The vast majority of that is our two skilled nursing facilities, about 70% today to run those two skilled nursing facilities at $82 million. We are about $10 million of core veteran services across the general fund. In the governor's recommended budget, we had about $19 million total for veteran services, but a different mix than you'll see with about $2 million general fund and the rest in lottery fund. So one of the central questions for the governor and for the legislature this session is how much of those lottery dollars are to be new and above and beyond supplemental efforts, and how much are simply covering the work that we already have been doing. And I think we've heard loud and clear since the governor's budget that the veterans community certainly thinks that those lottery funds are above and beyond and supplemental. Where we targeted in the governor's budget across our policy option packages, most agencies are fighting to get back to current service level just to do the work they're doing in this biennium rolled forward. We will have, looks like, current service level for our veterans' efforts going forward into the next biennium, plus some opportunities to improve our IT systems to lay the 21st century for our veterans' efforts, to invest in county veteran services, in those national service organizations with service officers, make investments in our aging veterans, and align funding that's been a historical, a long-time subsidy of our home loan program over to veteran services to align that for the long-term strength of both veteran services and our home loans. We have a little bit of a compliance mission back to the Fed VA on our home loan program, as well as investing in our headquarters and tenant improvements, but also looking a priority to use some of these funds, not just to get out to the county VSOs and service orgs, not just to invest in ODVA, but in community partners, specifically around supporting student veterans on community colleges and university campuses, mental health efforts, and then housing and homelessness. The last policy option package, 105, capital construction pitch to the tune of $2.5 million, to make sure that we're taking care of our two skilled nursing facilities for some of our most vulnerable and aging veterans. I think with that, and all of these, we will be going into depth with you throughout the session. We're up in one of the early ones in front of Ways and Means on our subcommittee. We flow through the Transportation Economic Development Subcommittee with housing, with Business Oregon, transportation, I think largely off of some of our bonded efforts on the home loan program. But we'll be up February 14th, Valentine's Day. So V is for veterans on that presentation day in front of Ways and Means. And I just want to thank all of you for inviting all of the testimony here today, but also for making one of the first actions to be House Concurrent Resolution 3, honoring the Rowden brothers and the Rowden family. I am proud to be the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, but there is no question that our Vietnam veterans are the leaders of our veterans community, whether it's Rep. Esquivel, our chair, Dennis Guthrie of our advisory committee, and many of the men and women behind me here today. Our Vietnam veterans weren't welcomed home in their own time, and they have been rectifying that ever since for every subsequent generation. And we are where we are because of that Vietnam veterans creating that step up for us today. So thank you for honoring them, and I am happy to take any questions or yield my time to the other presenters.
Before we open up for questions, I just want to commend Director Smith for managing so many different plates in the air right now as we move forward. And that I believe I speak for the rest of the committee that the Ways and Means budget actually had a little bit more in it for veterans services than you perhaps can always talk to. But we believe that the Ways and Means budget putting $23.5 million towards veterans was reflective of the importance that Ways and Means Committee sought, and I look forward to talking about how we can be good stewards of the opportunities that the people of Oregon have provided for veterans care and services. As I look for questions, I'd like to ask perhaps Ms. Heidi Stewart to come up. because the next, I'm going to move you out of order, and please come up early, because what she's going to talk about actually is aligned with some of the new things that ODVA started this past summer without additional resources. Before we begin that, are there any questions for Director Smith himself?
I have one thing.
Yes, sir.
Director Smith, why did you miss the opportunity to tell the chair, who's an Air Force major, that if it wasn't for the Marines, the Navy, and the Army to prop up all these flyboys, they'd fall down?
Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, we'll have a long session where I can continue to needle the chair and any other of the military branches.
Green is such a bad color. Envy is so bad. For those that are just tuning in, those that are sitting at home and have a computer, those that are sitting in the audience with a computer, committee members, please recognize that we actually have these materials that Director Smith referenced, as well as I believe Heidi has some comments that are also on the record. Don't forget to go to OLIS. You can print it out and see for yourself. If there's no other questions specifically for the director of ODVM, I'm going to ask him to remain in case there are questions about some of the projects that Heidi's going to talk about. So, right. Ms. Stewart, please take us away.
Absolutely. Happy to be here today. Chair Evans, members of the committee, my name is Heidi Stewart. I am the Assistant Director of the Offender Management and Rehabilitation Division with the Oregon Department of Corrections. And I'm here to talk to you today about the services that we provide to incarcerated men and women coming through our intake center, which is located in Wilsonville at the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility. And I know I'm speaking to the choir, but as you know, one of the most important aspects of working with incarcerated veterans is to assist them in understanding their earned benefits. During incarceration, disability compensation is reduced and pension and health care benefits are suspended. It is critical that the federal VA be notified immediately upon a veteran's incarceration so benefits are suspended or reduced and apportioned to family members. If the federal VA is not notified and payments continue, they are deemed overpayments and the veteran must repay those, that upon release. However, in order to be able to provide our veterans with this information, we have to know who these veterans are. And what we found was at intake, we would ask a question. They would fill out a form. We'd ask the question, are you a veteran? And many of our veterans would not check the box, or many non-veterans would check the box. So we had misinformation. Through collaboration and a strong working relationship with the Department of Veterans Affairs, and I'm going to pause here for just a moment really to give them kudos. We've been working with them very closely over the past at least year, and the passion that they have for incarcerated veterans is phenomenal, and we've been able to accomplish so much with their help. So I just wanted to make sure that they got the praise that they deserve. They've assigned a state, a VSO has been assigned to come to the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility twice a month, and they meet with people who identify as being veterans, and they started a process where they now verify the status of veterans. And starting in August of 2016 to today, of the people that have identified as being veterans, we know that 31% truly are veterans. And so at that time, we're able to then provide them with the information on the benefits that they have earned. With the information, if they are collecting benefits, we're able to stop that so they don't have to repay. And though many of them actually aren't even aware of the benefits that they've earned and that they could have access to. So we provide them with that information. When I say we, I mean our VSO from ODVA who comes up, provides our incarcerated veterans with that information so that upon release, they know what services they can access. Additional efforts are also underway to verify veteran status for those in our population. So this month, actually, ODVA is reaching out to everybody in our system who has identified as being a veteran, asking them to fill out a questionnaire. And that way, when they get the information back, they'll verify the status so that we'll know who in our system is truly a veteran. And that will allow us to be able to work with those veterans, especially prior to release, to get them set up with their earned benefits before walking out our door. I would also be remiss if I did not mention that I had the honor to chair the Task Force on Incarcerated Veterans. Work of the Task Force is outlined in a September 16, 2016 report, which is available online if you haven't seen it already. Work of the Task Force resulted in several recommendations on how to create a formalized veterans program within the Department of Corrections. And the good work happening at our intake center today is actually a direct result from the conversations had and recommendations made by the Task Force. And also because I am proud of the work that the Department of Corrections is doing among our veterans population, attached to my electronic testimony, you'll see a document detailing all of the other services that we have going on for veterans within our system. So I thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
I want to commend Ms. Stewart for not only sharing a task force with a lot of different opinions, but actually putting up with me for five months on that, and also emphasize that one of the things that certainly wasn't obvious to me is that it's very difficult to actually get the information about inmates because of a legal opinion about how information is shared.
Yes.
And if it seems frustrating that we actually have to do a questionnaire because we can't just look it up, there's actually a reason for that. So I want to really emphasize how much work went into this partnership between ODVA and DOC in finding ways to get to yes, finding ways to solve the problem. So you really, I think, in the short period of time have made a profound difference. Questions? Yes, sir. Go ahead.
You said that your information you're receiving was inaccurate, some of it. Is there any way that we, because there's one thing that anyone that's been in the service always remembers, that serial, their service number. And is there any way where we can give that serial number to maybe ODVA or someplace and it would quick check it? Is that possible?
I'll answer, Chair Evans, Representative. I'll answer part of that question, then I'll pass it over to Director Smith. The information is inaccurate because of the process that we had in place, and that veterans, when they come into our system, often don't identify as veterans. They just want to get through the intake process. They don't have a lot of trust for the Department of Corrections at that time. But with this new process that we have in place where ODVA is actually on site and they're having those conversations with the veterans, there's more trust there. But as far as being able to utilize that number, I'll pass it on to the director.
Mr. Chair, Representative Esquel, members of the committee, I think there is some added benefit to that in-person touch. It's certainly not a seamless check of a database. That largest database of veterans is going to be from the federal VA, and that's where we had the challenge of that legal opinion not allowing us to share without that permission from the veteran that we weren't able to get because of that trust gap as they're coming in to the institution. Sometimes I think veterans were thinking their benefits were going to get turned off and taken away and never turned back on as they were coming into the system, so a fear factor on that front. But it's been helpful. We're not going to be, so no, there's no one seamless automatic check of a database, but now through that VSO work, we're able to validate, are they or are they not a veteran, and have begin to keep on now on our database, you know, what benefits have they accessed, if any at all, so that we can connect them, any that they're able to, while they are in service and have it allotted to their family or in the corrections system, or when they're transitioning out, to make sure that reintegration is as smooth as possible. And I think the longer term benefit, not just for that veteran and their family transitioning back to society, but as we get this better data, the Criminal Justice Commission has been, they are truly that data guru on all things criminal justice, to begin feeding some of this veterans data into their work. To be able to see, have we broken the cycle at all on any of these folks coming in and out of the system through any of this work? Because there's that double down savings on the general fund side to a significant tune if we keep those folks from coming back to prison.
Any other questions? Well, one last comment. The thing that I am most excited about that this partnership has already accomplished is that the dramatic reduction in time it takes for someone that is being released to actually get benefits that they had previously been awarded. If I understand it correctly, it's about a 30-day turnaround now if there's no other appeal involved, which is an improvement of 9 or 10 months which can really dramatically impact the way people reintegrate. So,
yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that was really out of flexibility out of the federal VA regional office. What used to be months for those determinations, both to turn off and turn back on, are now a matter of days. And a huge make sure they aren't going into debt on the front end and have those benefits from the get-go on the back end. And I also want to thank Department of Corrections, obviously being secure facilities, making sure that we had access from our team, that we are allowed to bring in computers to be able to do the database work and the veterans claims was a huge coup of flexibility from their team as well.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
Okay. Next panel, Andy Smith, and if I could move out of order, bring up Vicki Horn as well, because she represents a particular county that Andy's going to be talking about. And Director Smith, you're certainly welcome to stay, or you can sit in the back, up to you.
I'll come back up if needed.
You're always welcome. And that's from an Air Force guy to a Marine guy.
Here we go.
Welcome to the committee.
Chair Evans and Vice Chair Esquivel and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Vicki Horn. I supervise Washington County's Veterans Service Office. I'm also an accredited Veterans Service Officer and a Marine. I served 5 years during the Gulf War, the first Gulf War in the early 90s, and like many Marines, had no idea of the benefits that were available to me upon discharge. I, of course, used my GI Bill, got my home loan, but did not realize that there were any other benefits that I would be eligible to receive. It was actually at training at ODVA to become an accredited Veteran Service Officer that I discovered that I too could be eligible for other benefits within the VA system, which is a very complicated system. So what veteran service officers do is we help veterans through that process. We're familiar with the Code of Federal Regulations that govern those rules. We know the best way to put in a claim and have a high success rate on receiving favorable decisions. We have 35,000 veterans in Washington County. Currently, we have records of POAs on about 9,000 of those. But we have a lot of work to do. And that's the part that's always a struggle for our office. While our county is very generous and we are well-funded, with a combination of County General Fund and with funds that pass through Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, it's always a struggle to determine if we should be doing more outreach to reach more veterans so that they realize what benefits are available, or seeing the veterans that come through our door every day. We're about 2 weeks to 3 weeks out on appointments with 7 veteran service officers. I don't know how the smaller counties do it. ODVA provides a lot of support for us. They provide our training. They provide outreach material, and they attend events. Veterans that access the system are passed through to the county where they reside. So if a Multnomah County veteran comes to our office, we have connections with the Multnomah County VSOs, and we would transfer them down to that office. Washington County, because of our proximity to the regional office, we handle all of our own appeals, which also increases our workload. But many of the other counties would not be able to do that because of the travel time to the regional office. So Portland's ODVA office covers those appeals. The appeals work for them. Many claims are denied the first time around, and it just takes somebody who's familiar with the rules to kind of identify the things that we need to be successful in the claims process. I did submit a one-page sheet that also talked about some of the other things that our office does. We help veterans enroll in health benefits. That's actually how we reach a lot of our veterans. They're getting ready to retire. They're not quite 65. They need health insurance, so they come in to see if they're eligible for the VA benefits. We help with transportation, connecting them with Ride Connection. Our office has a small contract with the veterans driving veterans. We help families enroll in CHAMP VA. We provide housing assistance. This year we were able to add a housing advocate, which is someone who helps the homeless veterans kind of navigate through the HUD-VASH process. In the past, they had to go down to downtown Portland to access those benefits through intake at the CRRC, which is can be difficult for a veteran that's homeless and has mental health issues. Downtown Portland is not always a welcoming environment. So we've been working with the federal VA to have their HUD-VASH person in our office on one day a month, and then our housing advocate kind of helps them through that process. We provide some emergency food and then information and referral to other benefits that are available to veterans in Washington County.
Thank you. Any questions?
Chair.
Yes, go ahead.
Quick question related to Washington County handling their own appeals. Is that standard practice? And is it? Did you volunteer to do it that yourself, or was it an option given to you? And what's the purpose of that?
So the Washington County has handled their own appeals, I believe, for about 5 or 6 years. I'm not exactly sure on the date. It was something that we took on our own. Because our county does support our program fairly well, we find that the representation that the veteran receives is just smoother that way. They don't have to keep retelling their story. We're familiar with their story from the start to the finish of the claim. I think Portland ODVA does an exceptional job of researching for the other counties that aren't able to come in and attend. But because our county does support our program so well, we're able to add that extra level of service.
Follow up, Chair. When it comes to, you said for the most claims that they're the first time around they are denied. What's that doesn't make sense.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to say that the most claims are. I said often what happens is that they will be denied. For example, I had a veteran come in and apply for hearing loss. He was a ammunition clerk. But he had worked at the airport for like 2 months. And so the exam came back saying that it was related to his work at the airport for that 2 month period. So a veteran may not know that that's something we can appeal, but a county veteran service officer looks at that exam and says, well, that's not a valid reason to deny the claim.
One thing that is, and again, this is a very complex process, but I just want to make sure I understand this.
Yeah.
County VSOs, service organization VSOs, and the state VSO, they can prepare claims. They can put together the best argument possible, but actually the feds decide.
Okay.
So it isn't the county denying. It's the county helping shepherd it through the process. So when the feds decide, then they basically help reload. And
once they've been denied from the federal, then they come to you for an appeal. Is that what I'm understanding?
So they come to, hopefully, they come to us first. We help them develop the best claim possible. We submit that through the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs to the federal VA. Then the VA comes back with a decision, and we get a copy of that decision, and then we help the veteran develop whether or not that's something we should appeal.
Okay, fantastic. Yeah, thank you very much for clarification on that.
And that's one of the issues that we have in our office is that the veterans often think that we're the VA.
Right.
They often think that ODVA is the VA. And really, we're your advocate to kind of work through that federal VA process.
The best part about the Oregon state system is that we're the advocates, we're the coaches, we're helping. We're never the ones saying no. That's the federal government, because that's their job.
Good to hear. Yeah. Okay, thanks.
Any other questions before we move to Andy? Andy, take it away.
Good afternoon, Chair Evans, Vice Chair Esquivel, members of the committee. My name is Andy Smith, and I'm the Veterans Policy Manager at the Association of Oregon Counties. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. Thank you, Vicki. I'm going to do a couple, and I'll tell you why, because we work for Vicki and all of the frontline folks, all of our CVSOs. But today I'd like to talk to you about what we do at AOC, how we kind of fit in this system, talk with you about a couple of state issues that are going on related to veterans policy and budget, some federal issues that we are tracking through our national association, and then finish kind of with a snapshot connected to veterans housing. So first off, Vicki is one of, right now we have 70 VSOs, at the CVSOs, employed by counties across the state. So that number would fluctuate. It's never exactly the same because we certainly have turnover. But right now that's how many staff that we have through our counties. AOC itself, we've been around since prior to Oregon's becoming a state. Counties have, but we've been an association since 1906. briefly, I haven't done this before in front of the committee, but to give you a little more perspective about AOC. AOC, we unite counties to help educate and promote collaboration with our key state and federal government partners to deliver many times what are shared services to our vital citizens. So in your packet, you've got this chart. Some of you may have seen it in other county discussions with other county folks. But just to, we don't have to go in great detail. If it's green, it's going to be primarily a state service. If it's blue, it's primarily a county service. And if it's red, it's kind of a shared services. It's a teamwork model. And you'll see that our veteran services are right square in the red in the column under human services. So I would say that we are very much hitting our stride in terms of this relationship over the last 4 to 5 years, our partnership with Director Smith's team. When I say that, I really mean his full team, from Director Smith himself all the way down. His entire staff has been very much supportive of the work that we do at AOC. Specifically, you've probably heard that has to do with training, technical support, appellate work, and partnership with our CVSOs. Our CVSOs, you've probably heard, but they're trained to be very successful. It's not by chance that they're successful. It's because of what ODVA invests in their training program. If I was going to use one term to describe what our CVS do, I would use the word they're MacGyvers. You know, they figure out solutions. Probably there's never a vet that probably has the same story or set of conditions exactly. So it's very personal work. It's based on relationships. And I would say that when Director Smith talked about the importance of the personal relationship, that's huge, because without having that connection to a veteran, you really can't prepare the type of claim you need to do. So that kind of people, that ability to connect to individuals and to be understand the vet, that's critically important. What else would I say? Vicki, how long did it take you to become accredited?
Well, I'm really smart, so about 6 months.
6 months. She's way above the curve. I think the actual is easily over 12 months, and it might be 18 months.
Yeah, it's
over. So, and that's a federal accreditation that isn't just given out by the federal government by any means. So what I wanted to do is start to jump to some state issues. So in your packet, there's a resolution that AOC adopted about a month ago. It has to do with the ballot measure 96, and our commissioners are very concerned about the idea that some of these general fund dollars could be swept in the process of kind of, you know,
so
what happens
we.
In this building. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like you would be as well. But we're right there with you, and we're very happy to see the community and veterans themselves begin to understand the opportunity here to utilize this money in a way that I think the voters are very clear about understanding. And there's a lot of language in the voters' pamphlet that was, we think, quite clear, our commissioners, that this was supplemental money. This wasn't money that was going to change colors and be moved around and diminished in any way. So that's one of our first priorities. You'll see in my testimony would be the support for implementing ballot measure 96. To touch upon a policy piece, a huge area that we think is ripe for opportunity would have to do with healthcare navigators or healthcare navigation. So a lot of the work that Vicki and our CVS do, they do healthcare work. You would advise people on how to access the system. But they primarily do the comp and pen and other benefits work. I mean, it takes so much time to do that when individual veterans have to navigate the VA system, you're really not just talking about the VA system, but you're talking, I think I read yesterday, about 30% of our veterans that are in the VA system are actually getting some form of community care, private care already. So there's this huge overlap with coordination. How does that work? There are all kinds of access issues, as you know, whether it be rural areas, whether it be transportation from maybe not rural areas, but just distances to VA medical facilities. It has to do with implementing the CHOICE Act. You heard about that. You know, what's next after the CHOICE Act? A number of issues related to healthcare navigation. But that whole idea, and there's a Senate bill that you'll hear, hopefully, would get over here, has to do with healthcare navigators. It's an ODVA bill. But what we'd like to do at AOC is really highlight the notion that this is an area where our veterans need more help when they're trying to access their VA medical benefits. Some things may be going well for a while. They hit a hiccup. They may never get started. All kinds of opportunities for people, this function of coordination of care. So it's not a huge number of people necessarily, but it's strategically how might the state partner with the VA or fund it on our own or whatever that might be to fill that area. So jumping to some federal issues, I guess before I want to a couple of budget issues at the federal level. In your packet, many of you have seen this. This is kind of that sheet that you can go back to and look all the time. This has all the VA, all the federal VA expenditures from housing to education to comp and pen to health care on one sheet for every single county. And you can see what when Cameron talked about that $2.6 billion, that's all on that. That's in your packet. But I've also included in your packet something that we're doing at our national level, and that is tracking the VA federal budget. Not just what is in a headline about this happens or this or that, but what's happening to their budget. So we don't know, obviously, what's going to happen. But what I included in your packet and what we'd like to encourage you to do as state legislators, along with any partners that we have, our federal delegation, is, again, to track what's being proposed relative to the federal VA budget. So two sheets or two handouts. One had to do with just the trend line of it's in your you can look at over time what's happened to the VA budget since 1940 to 2012. So you can see in real dollars and in nominal dollars what that budget is. There's another page in the packet that talks about fiscal year 2017. And it looks like this. It's a resource for you to have, but I'll just read the column. So for fiscal year 2017, the VA budget at the federal level, both for the VBA, Veterans Benefits Administration, which is comp and pen, and then the VHA, which is the healthcare side, together, they equal $176.9 billion. So, again, this is something that you can – I don't think the needs are going to diminish in the short term for our veterans. That's something that we can watch in terms of what's going to be what's the new goal in terms of Congress and the new president. In particular, some of the programs at the federal level you've heard about that we want to keep our eye on would be the VASH program, Veterans Affairs Supported Housing Program for homeless veterans, and the SSBF program, which is kind of a very flexible funding stream for veterans and their families related to housing. So those have specific funding levels that we would hope would continue to grow. We want to keep our eye on that. As you know, there will be a new VA secretary. Dr. Shulkin, I think, was very well received yesterday in Congress. But he will have a new strategic plan that I think it's important that we understand what are his goals and how do we help him and his administration be accountable. And I think counties and state legislatures can help provide that accountability. And then I think something for Oregon that's very important that we always try to keep our eye on is the issue of rural veterans and veterans that live great distances from many services, including their health care services. So those are the areas at the federal level. And then if I wanted to just briefly take a snapshot related to housing, you know, how does that intersect with this housing discussion in this building? And I think it's really very practical, and that is if you look at the average size of the benefit for a disability payment in Oregon, it's around just under $1,600 a month. So if a veteran and their spouse all of a sudden went from not having a VA disability benefit to having one, that would be housing. That would support housing, and that would provide a great deal of housing stability. So if we could get to something like Oklahoma, which is $1.8 billion instead of $1.3, what is that, about a third, a 30% increase? Many of our veterans at some point probably as in their senior years may face some housing instability or housing uncertainty or homelessness. So I don't think it's complicated to think that some of our veterans' outreach can dramatically improve or affect many of our citizens' ability to have housing. And with that, I'll stop, but I do want to again thank Vicki and her staff at Washington County. I think you have the largest office probably in the state, but you guys have great numbers. You've been doing it for a long time. But across the state, I think you should be very proud of our VSOs, but I think you should also be just as proud of the way that the teamwork that the state supports them. Oregon is one of the strongest states. Many states have county-based systems, but I'm not quite sure if that link between the state and the counties is as strong in too many other states. I would guess we're in the top five. Thank you.
Questions?
Yes, Mr. Post.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if it'll be a good question for today, but I want to make sure I remember it today because Andy said a couple of things that fell into where I was thinking. Quick story, we put a house up for sale back in July, and it 3 days it was sold, you know, somebody made an offer on it, and it was through a veterans loan. It was going to be through a veterans loan. Through a series of events, we found out that there are apparently only two appraisers in the entire state. Does that sound correct? So they told me there was one on the east side, one on the west side. So it took, is this an old subject?
No, I've heard the same thing.
Have you? Okay. And it might not be the right day for it, maybe another day, but it just, there were a couple of words you said. So anyway, long story short, it took 6 months. And what I found was that, and we went ahead and lived through it, and just because we wanted to sell it to these nice people. But I found that there were people, and discrimination isn't the right word, I don't think, mm-hmm. but people were saying, I don't want to have a veteran buy a house from me because it's going to take 6 months to get this done. So is this a federal issue or a state issue?
Okay, so I have another member wants to answer on that.
Okay.
And then we'll give Andy
a
chance.
Yeah, I don't care who.
Be happy to. What it is there's a list that appraisers have to get on for federal VA. Here's the real sad part about this. The VA criteria is the same as FHA criteria. So if you're a member of the club, you get those. But if you haven't signed up to be a member of the club, then it takes you a while to get on it. Why? I have no idea, because it's the same criteria. If you have an FHA loan or a VA loan, it's the same criteria that qualifies the house for sale, for the sale. So it's one of those things I think we should maybe ask our congressional delegation why they haven't fixed that in the VA.
Okay, so on this question, because I know you had a different question you wanted to ask, do you guys want to add anything on that? Or
Can I just, Chair, can I add that? So the VA home loan program is actually just a guarantee of your loan. Mm-hmm. It's, the appraisers are licensed. I mean, they're not licensed through the, it's not a VA licensed right. appraiser. So it has to do with the mortgage company list of
VA
who's approved
certification,
to
VA. Though.
Well, that's going to say, I was told by my mortgage company that only VA appraisers can appraise VA loans. So that is not the normal appraiser can do that.
I would be happy to do some research on that and yeah. send it to you if you'd like.
Let's get back to that one as a side issue.
Yeah.
Good question. Important to know. Let's put that one down. And you had a different question, and then
I would like to ask AOC if every 2 years, every session, long session, I do a request of the federal government to put the VA system into dedicated funding instead of discretionary funding. I was wondering if the counties could do the same thing so we can maybe hit them a little harder, because I've been in this building now 13 years and they've ignored it every year. Well, because I think that's something we need to do.
Do you want to respond to that?
Representative Esquivel, Chair Evans, it's a great idea. I think just looking here, I didn't know it before I'd seen this data, that it looks like about a third of the money is discretionary,
right.
and mm-hmm. two-thirds is mandatory. So that's a point well noted. Thank you.
Good point.
Yes, Chair. Sir. Go ahead. Yeah, thank you. And I just want to, well, thank you, Representative Post, for hanging in there. I'm a realtor also with the real estate transaction, and I did three transactions last year that were, three of them were veteran approved VA loans, and two of them we were able to get closed. I was very happy to do that, but one of them, we was out in the Estacada area, and it was out of the metro area, and it was taking 4 months to close, and it has to be a specially certified VA appraiser, and there aren't that many qualified VA appraisers, and that deal almost they almost lost the deal. And actually, what happened, they had to, in order to keep the transaction together, the seller said you have to change your financing. So they went to conventional financing, but weren't able to, you know, utilize the benefits of the VA loan. And so I think that is something that we really need to look at, because there are a lot of, I did a meeting out in the Columbia County area with the realtors out there, and there are veteran, you know, approved buyers that are not able to take advantage of the veterans. And it's getting stigmatized because sellers do not want to work and cooperate with the VA loan. So we don't, that's defeating the purpose. So I think we need to work on improving.
We'll add it to the work list. Go ahead.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, again. But we also discussed this quite some time ago before Cameron was ever on board, and that was to mirror the federal VA with our Oregon Department of Veteran Affairs loan system. So therefore, it was the same criteria and the same loan, whereas it'd be 100% instead of 97%, I think is what it is today, 90% loan to value. So I don't know how we're progressing on that, but I guess it's up to practically have the Act of Congress to get it through. But I don't know how we're doing. But that would alleviate the whole thing, because then we could do it in the state of Oregon.
So based on the discussion here, if it's all right, one of the Thursdays coming up, we'll ask Cameron Smith to bring his home loan folks in,
yes.
Maybe some appraisers, maybe some real estate, some other folks, and we can actually get to the. And certainly we'd invite Vicki to be a part of that if you want.
But thank you, Chair. Thank you.
I think that's a good piece to move forward. Housing actually is the next issue on the docket that we're going to be bringing folks up to talk about. But before we bring up the next panel, I just want to thank both of you. Vicki, for being there in the trenches trying to help the vets and running your team to do that. And Andy, you really are a resource for us on so many different issues. And for new members to the committee, I just want to make sure that you know that Andy is very humble about the things he does, but he has a lot of insight into the nexus, really, where most of the veterans' issues come to play in terms of at the county level, at the local level, in terms of housing, support, other services. So to the extent that as discussions move forward, you have specific questions, Andy's a really good resource that I commend. So thank you both for being a part of today. And we're going to call up the next panel, Department of Housing Director Salazar, and also Mr. Barry Pack.
Housing
and lottery. We'll start with housing, and then we'll pivot to lottery.
Thank you so much.
And welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Evans, Vice Chair Esquivel, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Margaret Salazar, and I'm the new director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. It's my honor to be with you this afternoon, and I'll be presenting to you some information about our agency, about homelessness amongst the veteran population here in Oregon, and a few key programs that we're administering to address veteran housing and homelessness issues. So just to back up and start to give you a frame of our mission, our vision is that all Oregonians have the opportunity to pursue prosperity and to live free from poverty. And our mission is to provide stable and affordable housing and to engage leaders to develop integrated statewide policy that addresses poverty and provides opportunity for all Oregonians. I wanted to start by giving you a snapshot, and you may be familiar with some of these statistics, about Oregon's homeless veterans. As you may know, data on homelessness is collected through what's called the point in time count, which is done every other January as overseen by the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And the last point in time count that was completed was in January of 2015. Point in time count probably just occurred in the last couple of weeks here throughout the state, but of course we don't have that data yet. So these are the most current statistics we have. And what we see is that across the state, the total homeless population is over 13,000, and we have nearly 1,500 homeless veterans that were accounted for in that point in time count. So homeless veterans comprise about 11% of the total number of people experiencing homelessness that were counted in that point in time count 2 years ago. And 4 in 10 homeless veterans were considered chronically homeless, meaning that they have a disabling condition and were homeless continually at least for 12 months or for at least 4 times over a 3-year period. You have some demographic information in your packets, which you can look at in your own time. But one thing I wanted to just call out for you is that if you look at the race and ethnicity of homeless veterans in Oregon, you'll see that communities of color are disproportionately represented. So we have a large number of American Indian and African American homeless veterans when compared to the overall population in Oregon, something for you to note and be aware of. To address this issue of veteran housing needs, the Oregon legislature took action in a couple of very important ways. So in 2009, Oregon created the document recording fee, which added a $15 fee to the recording of real property documents to fund affordable housing. And then in 2013, HB 2417 added an additional $5 specifically to serve veteran, a $5 set aside. And by statute, the fee is divided into 3 purposes, and each of them includes a set-aside for veteran housing. So there's the Emergency Housing Assistance Program, the Homeownership Assistance Program, and the General Housing Account Program. And I'll be speaking about each of these programs today. I'll start with the Emergency Housing Assistance Program. So the Emergency Housing Assistance Veterans Document Recording Fee, the EHA VET DRF, assists low or very low income veterans who are homeless or at risk of becoming homeless to acquire and sustain stable housing. The funds are awarded on a quarterly basis, and we grant funds to 17 community action agencies that represent all 36 Oregon counties.
It's getting darker. Yeah.
It's not just me.
No.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So the funds through this EHA program can pay for transitional housing, rapid rehousing, these are rental assistance programs, homelessness prevention, street outreach, supportive in-home services, data collection, community capacity building, and emergency shelter as well. So to give you an update on where we are with the EHA program, so for the EHA VET DRF 1517 allocation to date has been over $700,000. The current expenditures are $447,000 roughly. So the remainder is $262,250, about 37% of the funds remain. So we are ahead of our targets for getting those funds out the door. And from July 1st, 2015 through June 30th of 2016, we provided services for 602 individuals, 443 adults, and 159 children. And of the adults served, 16% were on active military duty, 337 households, and 308 bed nights of shelter. And when I say we provided these services, of course what I mean is that working through our network of community action agencies across the state, we together were able to provide those services. And we have some information about EHA and who it has reached. So within the total veteran population served, a combined total of over half were either suffering from a severe mental illness or another disability. So you have some breakdowns here, so you see some of the issues that the veterans were struggling with that were served through this program. And I wanted to give you an example of one story of the Emergency Housing Assistance in Action. So through our partner, UCAN, in Josephine County, UCAN assisted a 57-year-old veteran, homeless single mother, in April 2015. She was living in a local emergency shelter. She had lost custody of her 15-year-old son, and her sole income came from TANF, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, at just $432 each month. So caseworkers at UCAN enrolled her in the Supportive Services for Veteran Families, SSVF program, that's through the Veteran Affairs Department, and began work on her stabilization plan, and she set the following goals: to regain custody of her son, to secure permanent housing, to finish her SSDI claim, and to file for compensation for a service-connected disability. After 6 months of hard work and working with UCAN, she was able to complete all of those goals. And we believe that the housing assistance was foundational to get her the stability to be able to focus on those broader goals. The second main component of the document recording fee is the General Housing Account Program, so I'll turn to that now. So OHCS issues a GHAP Veterans Housing Notice of Funding Availability every other year. And in November 2015, we were able to award $3.7 million to fund two projects serving low-income veterans. The 2017 GHAP Veterans NOFA will be issued in spring of 2017, so just coming up in a couple of months. So I'll describe to you the two great properties that we were able to support. The first is Victory Commons, which is an 11-unit project in downtown Klamath Falls. It was awarded just over $2 million in Veterans GHAP resources. It includes five HUD-VASH supportive housing vouchers, and it's a partnership between the Department of Veterans Affairs, Klamath Lake Community Action Services, Klamath Housing Authority, Treatment Court, and Behavioral Health Services. This project was completed last fall, so I look forward to visiting it, and I hope that you all get the opportunity to do so as well. It's made up of five duplexes of one-bedroom units, including a community room, a laundry room, and a manager's space. And the second project that we funded back in 2015 was Victory Place, which is a 17-unit project in Medford. It was awarded $1.7 million in Veterans GHAP resources. It includes 10 HUD VA supportive housing vouchers, and it's a partnership with Access, Rogue Valley Veterans, and Community Outreach, and others. So we're excited about these two projects that would not have been possible were it not for these capital resources going into the program. And then finally, the third prong of the document recording fee is the Homeownership Assistance Program. So after creation of the Veterans Document Recording Fee, a stakeholder group came together and set priorities for the use of those additional funds to support homeownership for veterans. And the priorities that they developed were down payment assistance for veterans through ODVA for the ORVET loan, rehab, repair, and adaptation for veterans to remain in their home, so preventing folks from falling into housing insecurity or potentially homelessness, and mortgage payment assistance program for returning unemployed veterans. So I have a status update for you on that program. We entered into an interagency agreement with our friends at ODVA back in April 2015, and we were able to move forward on putting together a program to administer the down payment and closing cost assistance program. We did run into some complexities with the Department of Veterans Affairs restrictions and some overlap between programs, and so we got some feedback from our friends at ODVA and members of the Veterans Advisory Group. And we're now creating a new program, a new request for application for a rehab and repair program for homeless veterans. So the 2017 Single Family Veterans RFA of $1.5 million will open statewide with geographic diversity to nonprofit corporations, local housing authorities, and local governments. And the program will function where the funds will be used for health, safety, adaptability and habitability projects for veterans, such as grab bars, accessibility ramps, and other upgrades. Applications will be scored by an interagency committee of OHCS, ODVA, and Business Oregon. We hope to get this live this spring. The scoring committee recommendations are anticipated in March, and we hope to be able to get the funds out on the street in April. So we look forward to rolling that program out quickly. You've heard certainly today from the other testimony about the importance of the federal commitment to end veteran homelessness. And I just want to note that, of course, you know, for the last several years, the federal government has come out strongly with a commitment to end veteran homelessness. It's an interagency commitment that's been rolling out. And we've seen increased funding through the VASH program, supportive services for veteran families. And we've seen communities in Oregon here take up the mayor's challenge to end veteran homelessness. So both Portland and Eugene, Multnomah County, and Lane County have signed on to that challenge to end veteran homelessness. And what we've seen is that that targeted approach has really galvanized support in communities and has really been able to move the dial. So, for example, in Eugene, the local community set a goal of housing 365 homeless veterans through something called Operation 365. Mm-hmm. But through the energy and the focus of all the local partners, really focusing on targeting that community, they were able to house more than 400 veterans in that time. So that just shows that that sort of commitment really can make a difference, and we're excited about that. So I just wanted to note that we at Oregon Housing Community Services, we've been involved in that effort, but we want to be more intentionally involved and to see how we can align our programs beyond the document recording fee to help local communities to continue to meet that goal. So I wanted to go over a few of the additional resources that we administer through our agency that also touch the lives of veterans. So we administer a variety of resources to projects with units targeted for veterans through our multifamily finance program, which creates affordable housing homes, both new construction and preservation. We've supported projects that include apartments and or services specifically for veterans. So one example, just this last month, we made awards to 12 properties around the state through our new LIFT program, which is an affordable housing development program. And one of those is called Freedom Square Part 2 in White City, and it includes 8 units of permanent supportive housing for homeless veterans using project-based HUD-VASH vouchers, and it's a partnership between the Housing Authority of Jackson County, the VA of Southern Oregon, and the Southern Oregon Rehab Center and Clinics, who are partnering to provide supportive services. So we were proud to be a partner in that program, and again, that wasn't specifically a veteran set-aside, but we're pleased that folks are using our financing resources to make these units available for veterans. We're focusing on developing supportive housing models to help integrate housing and healthcare so that we can help address the needs of veterans, particularly with disabilities. And as we start development of a broad statewide housing plan, which is a larger effort of our agency, we're also planning to focus our efforts on addressing the needs in particular of veterans. But as we know, where these programs really really make a difference is on the ground. And so that's why today I've also invited a couple of guests to join me here to tell the story about how these resources are really working in local communities. So I'd like to invite two friends, Linda Strike and Breezy Aguirre of the Mid-Willamette Community Action Network, to talk for just a couple of moments about these document recording fee resources and what they're meaning on the ground in communities to veterans that are our neighbors. So folks, if you'll join me.
Don't go too far, Barry. I'm watching you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Chair Evans, Vice Chair Esquivel, and committee, I'm Linda Strike, and I am here from Mid-Willamette Valley Community Action Agency. I'm a program manager, and part of what I manage are our veteran service programs. The document recording fee portion for veterans is part of that. One is being provided to you now is an overview of all of our veteran programs, because in order to really make sure that veterans are getting maximum assistance that is going to do the very best for them and help them move forward and be stable in their housing, we do leverage the document recording fee money with other veteran programs, because the money from the document recording fee, if we were to hire a staff person to do something with it, there would be no money to put out the door. And so it has really made a big difference in the number of people that we've been able to serve. It has also made a huge difference in our ability to truly get somebody to a place of stability, because the supportive services for veteran families dollars has a, you know, 6 month or 9 month maximum, and when you're working with chronically homeless, that's just barely enough time for them to get their feet under them. So by leveraging the two things together, we're able to create a much more stability plan with somebody so that they can truly be moving forward. And then Breezy is a case manager here, and so she has a couple of stories that can really attest to the big difference that it has made in the community.
Okay. Two stories? Okay. Two's good.
Okay. Chair Evans, committee members, for the record, my name is Breezy Aguirre. I am a case manager with Supportive Services for Vets and Families program. For about the last 3 years, I've been working with this program. So I'm just going to kind of jump right into it. We serve Polk and Marion. So for Polk County, I had the honor to work with a couple. The veteran was the husband in the family, and they were literally homeless. They were living in their vehicle. They had been in a car accident and unfortunately lost everything. They were unable to work, and they were waiting to have surgery done so that they're waiting to be housed so they could have the surgery done in order to start rehabilitation. By using the VetDIR funds, we were able to pay the deposit and the first month's rent on an apartment in Dallas. We were then able to enroll them in another veterans program that would take over helping with subsequent months. Freeing up the funds normally used for deposits, it made it possible for us to assist this household longer while he recovered from surgery and physical therapy. The household is now working on permanent employment, paying over half of their monthly rent. Without the assistance of the EHA Vet DRF, they would have risked being exited from programs before he was able to properly heal. And so right now, he does have a clean bill of health, and he's well on his way to self-sufficiency. In Marion County, I was given the honor to work with a veteran that was also working with the Marion County Vet Court. He came to us, he was very motivated to begin turning his life around and starting a clean and sober life. First step was finding him a place to live, and first he found an available unit close to a mentor. We were able to use the EHA Vet DRF funds to pay his deposit, first month's rent, and get him into the unit. We immediately began working on budgets and goals. His goal was to be off of our program within 3 months, and within 3 months he was self-sufficient and no longer needs the need of our services. By using the document recording fee, it made it possible for the client to access the case management piece of our other veterans programs while not using any funds. So in the future, if there is a need, he still has eligibility in those other programs.
Great.
Well, thank you.
Thank you both for your comments and for putting a face and a story on the process. Any questions for the panel? Go ahead.
maybe a question or more of a statement, maybe. But, you know, we talk about affordable housing in this state. We talk the talk, but we don't walk the walk. When does the municipality step up to the plate and drop their SDC charges? Example, a fellow came in from Portland and said he bought a $100,000 lot, or an $80,000 lot, and the city of Portland charged him $40,000 on top of that for SDCs. Well, how can you have affordable housing when you're doing that? I see that they want everyone else to drop their costs, but I don't see the municipalities dropping theirs. So it's something to think on, maybe, for the future.
I know in Monmouth Independence we would gladly help with much reduced SDCs of that. But thank you.
Anyway.
Thank you very much for being here. And again, as we develop the work plan for the rest of the session, leveraging these resources, as you guys have been doing, will be a vital point. So thank you very much for being a part of it.
Thank you.
Director Pack, last but certainly not least, you've gotten to hear what programs are being fielded and how veterans are being helped, and now the lottery funds set aside. We would like to learn more, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Barry Pack, director of the Oregon State Lottery. And to continue the bias of the chair, my father is retired Air Force and was a veteran of the Korean War.
God bless you. I knew.
Born on base at Triple General in Honolulu.
Oh,
so
you're going to have to go out on strike.
The music to my ears. This is a great thing.
I'd like to start just giving a brief overview of the lottery, how we're organized and structured and operate, and then talk about our primary relationship. Thank you. With our beneficiaries. The mission of the Oregon State Lottery is to operate a lottery with the highest standards of security and integrity to earn maximum profits for the people of Oregon, commensurate with the public good. That's our internal summary of statutory language that directs the lottery in its operations. And I want to just briefly mention that
the light is going down. In case you ask,
Okay. I'm not getting faint. It's a little warm in here for an Air Force brat. we have to operate with a careful balance between maximizing profits, which means generating revenues, obviously, for important programs like veteran services, and doing so in commensurate with the public good, and a recognition that gambling addiction is a real problem and can cause serious issues for people's lives and families. And I'll get back to that a little bit later as it relates to veterans. Quickly, just a glance at the history of the lottery, and the purpose of this slide is really to point out that, by and large, the dedication of lottery revenues has been a voter-driven endeavor. The legislature's actually had very little to do with making those dedications or changes, with the exception in 2005. As it relates to sports betting, most of the dedication of funds and the direction of those funds have come from voter-approved ballot measures. Of course, most recently, ballot measure 99 and 96, adding veteran services and outdoor schools to the recipients of lottery funds. We have two major categories of product in our portfolio mix. We have traditional games, which we offer, our draw and instant win games, so Powerball, scratch-it tickets, those sorts of things. Brought in fiscal year 2016 a little over $350 million. That's about 28-29% of total lottery revenues. And you can see there the three sort of most popular games in terms of revenue generation. The video product is the vast majority of the revenues that we bring into the state, about 71% in the last fiscal year. These are run out of on-premise licensed by OLCC locations with age-restricted areas. You have to be 21 and over to play video lottery, 18 and over to purchase a draw or scratch ticket. We operate a wide area network with over 3,900 retailer locations across the state. These are grocery stores, convenience stores, bars, taverns, restaurants. They are small businesses and large multi-state corporations. It's quite the mix. And again, that brought in fiscal year 2016 over $875 million in the net revenues that go to the state. So that's not total sales. So let me talk a little bit about growth of the lottery. This graph shows you a little bit that with some care and feeding, revenues can grow over time. We started back in 1985, our first year of operations, only selling scratch tickets. And brought in, I can't see that far, I gotta look at my notes here, only $32 million. And you'll see with the introduction of new games over time, that revenue has grown significantly up until the point where we hit calendar year 7, fiscal year 8, where we had two big perfect storms hit the lottery. The first was a statewide smoking ban. Patrons could no longer smoke in bars and taverns where they were used to going and playing video lottery, and then the start of the Great Recession. Up until the Great Recession, lottery revenues had been fairly recession-proof. We might see a small dip in revenues, but generally speaking, not a large one. The Great Recession proved us not to be recession-proof, and on top of the smoking ban, we took some significant reductions in revenue. With the economic rebound and some modernization of some of our terminals, we're beginning to see revenues climb back up. We've had our second year of $1.2 billion in profits. And when we look at our revenues adjusted for inflation, however, we are still 18% below the peak in 2007. So we are recovering nominally year over year. Our revenues are growing. We just haven't fully recovered the losses from that period of time. Just quickly, how the money works, actually. So the lottery sales are gross proceeds that come in to our organization, and they're transferred to the state treasury. They pay our bills. They pay prizes to players. And the remaining, which are net proceeds, get transferred to the Department of Administrative Services. They pay debt service on revenue-backed, lottery-backed revenue bonds. They replenish reserves that help maintain those bonds, and then distribute the rest to the beneficiaries. There is a portion of the distribution of lottery net proceeds that go to the legislature for economic development education purposes, and those are the discretionary lottery resources that you have to budget within those broad categories of economic development and education. So last biennium, we transferred over $1.2 billion back to the state. You can see the breakout by broad beneficiary category. And then I've also provided you historical totals since the beginning of the lottery, over $11 billion back to the state, and the distribution to the four primary beneficiaries up until this point in time. I want to talk just briefly about our corporate social responsibility program. We run a nationally certified and recognized responsible gambling problem gambling program. Within the first couple of months I was on the job here, I had the honor of going to New York to the National Council on Problem Gambling Conference and accept our certification and an award for corporate social responsibility. It's a great thing to be on the job for 2 months and get national awards.
Congratulations.
Thank
That's
you.
Good.
Yeah. I take no credit for it. My staff and our partners in the treatment and prevention communities are responsible for it. But we are a leader in the country for responsible gambling and problem gambling programs. We were one of the first four states to be nationally certified and the only state that runs a video lottery program to have a nationally certified responsible gambling program. I mentioned this importance of this part of our work, and particular as it relates to veterans, because veterans are a special population for treatment and prevention for gambling addiction. There are studies, although none in Oregon, to give a sense of Oregon veterans who have a gambling addiction problem. But our addiction prevalence overall as a state is at about 2.6% of Oregonians have a chronic gambling addiction problem. Nationally, numbers that I've seen among veterans populations, that number's up to 8 to 10%. So there's a number of factors for that are fairly speculative, but particularly among combat veterans who come back with perhaps mental health issues, drug and alcohol issues, you see a lot of co-diagnoses of these sorts of addictions. So it's important. Our partners in OHA and the treatment and prevention community have special outreach programs to veterans for gambling addiction, which, you know, if you'd like to hear more, I'm sure they'd be happy to come talk about those at a future meeting. And I lost my train of thought on that. Sorry about that. Wanted to talk about quickly where we're going as an organization for the lottery. I think it's important for our beneficiaries to know where our revenues look going long term. We are modernizing our gaming platforms to keep pace with the industry. Technology continues to develop, as you know. And that's true in the gaming industry as in anything. So we are updating the video terminals that are out in our retailer locations, as well as our internal gaming operating system, which will allow us to push game content out to our retailers centrally from the headquarters in Salem. It'll allow us to segment our market a little bit better, target games to the communities and players where they're more popular, and not have to have a one-size-fits-all approach across the state. Internally, we're looking at our internal business processes and systems, and like any 30-year-old state organization, we're working on legacy systems that are end-of-life and unsupportable, and so we're putting together a roadmap for an eventual upgrade and replacement plan. Our goal here is to leverage efficiencies. We're a pretty manual organization for as technologically dependent as we are, and to look to be able to leverage data across the network. I mentioned before, we're building a robust social corporate responsibility program, and we're developing and we'll execute a responsible revenue strategy to see how we can keep our revenues growing. And I want to emphasize responsible. We cannot develop a revenue strategy that asks our current players to play more or wager higher. We need to reach out to other players with new content that is appealing and work to help make sure that they're playing, but playing responsibly as well. And then, of course, we'll welcome our two newest beneficiaries to the Lottery family, Outdoor Schools and Veterans Services. And I want to talk a little bit about what that means. Generally speaking, our beneficiaries are our brand. The voters approved the lottery to fund important state programs, and that continues to drive their opinion about the lottery itself and where and how those dollars are spent. Our research shows that 65% of adult Oregonians have a positive opinion about the lottery, and among those who have that positive opinion, the vast majority state the programs and the projects that get funded by lottery dollars as the primary reason. When asked about how they feel about lottery dollars doing for Oregon, 72% are positive, and 91% of adult Oregonians can correctly identify at least one beneficiary of lottery revenues. One out of three can identify all four, with public education being the most commonly understood recipient of lottery dollars. And, you know, lottery raises revenues through games, and we transfer them to the state, who then transfers them out to beneficiaries. So we don't have any, you know, when I got started at the lottery, all my friends asked me, well, how do you decide who gets the money? And I said, I just raise it. That's already been decided. So we don't have any direct interaction with the programs that are funded by lotteries directly. What we do partner with our beneficiaries is in brand awareness, both of where lotteries dollars go and then how our beneficiary organizations spend them. So we run throughout the year a broad advertising campaign that highlights all of the beneficiaries of Oregon lottery dollars, and then throughout the year we'll do smaller advertising campaigns about a particular beneficiary. So, for instance, we just launched our Teacher of the Year advertising. It's a partnership with the Department of Education where we recognize a Teacher of the Year every year. We advertised that teacher. This year was a teacher out of Medford. I'm sorry, Representative Esquivel. I had to step out at that point in time, but it's a nice way to feature the hard work of teachers and then the support that lottery dollars give to education. So before I pause for questions, I just wanted to show a couple examples of our beneficiary advertising. And obviously, as money starts to flow into Veterans Services beginning July 1st of 2017, we'll be able to add them into the mix. And when we have some stories to tell about how those funds are being used, we can highlight that in some of our promotional and sponsorship and advertising campaigns. But if I may, Mr. Chair?
Absolutely.
This is our 30th anniversary campaign, which launched last calendar year, and I can manage this left-handed.
The people of Oregon created our lottery to make the state we love an even better place to live, work, and play. And over the past 30 years, that's meant billions of dollars for supporting public schools, for growing Oregon's economy, for maintaining state parks, and enhancing vital watersheds, keeping our heart in all the right places. are based on chance and should be played for entertainment only.
And then this is the current campaign that's running on air right now.
Oregon is an inspiration. Whether you come to it or are born to it, you become entranced by our state's beauty, the opportunity she affords, and the independent spirit of her citizens.
Thanks to you, $10 billion of lottery funds for schools, parks, jobs, fish, and wildlife help make Oregon our Oregon. Lottery games are based on chance and should be played for entertainment only.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Yes?
So quick question. Well, maybe not quick. The when you talked about the bonding and sort of, so we have lottery-backed bonds, and you do pay for those first before the funds get distributed back to us for the sort of discretionary portion of that we use in our budgeting process?
Yeah, so net proceeds go to DAS, and they pay the state's obligations to lottery-backed revenue bonds first.
First.
Yes.
Because I think, Treasurer Wheeler had mentioned that there's actually nothing in the law that requires that they're paid first. He had to get some good. When we were first bringing Measure 96 in 2013, he asked me to, if I could amend it to do a cleanup of the Constitution around lottery. Are you familiar with that cleanup?
Mr. Chair, Representative Parrish, no. Sorry about that.
And one other follow-up. Yeah. So on the bonding piece, I mean, that seems to be a pretty popular tool around here. We want to do lottery-backed bonds for any number of projects in people's districts. At what point does that, like, at what point do we start to, for the things that voters have actually voted on, run out of money? I mean, are you tracking that in terms of giving us advice in terms of stop bonding?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Parrish. We work in partnership with the Department of Administrative Services and the Office of Economic Analysis, who also work with the Investment Council and the Debt Policy Advisory Board, all of whom have a say in the state's bonded indebtedness and our bond ratings. Lottery revenue bonds are limited to 25% of our net proceeds, so you can't. There is a ceiling you can no longer bond for. I will just say that we are currently bonded out through 2035, and I believe there's a spring bond issuance coming up, so it is ongoing.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, sir.
So, Mr. Pack, I just want to say that as a person that's never used any of these, and maybe you'll find some way to get me enticed into it, but I appreciate the approach from really educating Oregonians about what the value is of that. And it's really helped me, not being one, again, that plays it or was in support of it early on, but it does help me appreciate what it's brought to the state. So I think the approach, and especially that you're doing now, is good work.
Thank you.
Chair.
Mr. Post, do you have a question?
Oh, no, I just wanted to point out that was the song that's played between the first and second quarter of every Duck football game, and I was hoping that you get permission to use that song, because it's very important to Duck football fans.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative Post, we did license the rights to use that song. And I will tell you that our staff who work at University of Oregon games have often heard when it's played, "Oh, that's the lottery song."
Oh, holy cow.
As it should be. Excellent.
There you go.
Good call. All right. Well, thank you very much for coming and teaching us a lot about this as July comes and goes and we look at where the dollars have an impact. Look forward to working with you on how we can make sure that folks that maybe haven't ever played before but might want to help veterans programs realize that's an opportunity. So thank you very much for coming in. Sorry for the delay in your testimony.
No worries. Thank you very much.
All right. What we're going to do now is we're actually going to open a public hearing. We're going to close the informational hearing first. It's now closed. Now we're going to open a public hearing on HCR 3. Staff summary first, and then we'll call up people to share their thoughts.
Thank you, Chair. This is for HCR 3. This particular resolution recognizes and honors two brothers, Private James Herbert Rowden, 1944 to 1966, and Private First Class John Wayne Rowden, 1946 to 1968, who were killed in action during the Vietnam War. The Rowden family and two brothers resided in Jackson County, Oregon. Both brothers were assigned to a Marine amphibious force, and they were killed in action about 2 years apart, each at age 21. Both parents of the two brothers are deceased. The last surviving member is Malcolm Rowden, present residing in Medford, Oregon. And the Rowden family is one of only 39 families nationwide to lose two sons in the Vietnam War.
Okay. And we're going to invite Mr. Steve Bates to come forward and share some thoughts and how this normally works for folks who have not seen these HCRs before. We have a brief discussion usually here in committee, but the day of the actual floor vote, we invite the family and we make certain that folks that especially are important to the family have an opportunity to be there when the House renders honors. So, Mr. Bates, please go ahead.
Chair Evans, Vice Chair Esquivel, and committee members, I'm Steve Bates, and I'm from Boring. And yes, it is, because I'm not there. For over 20 years, our nation was involved in a military conflict that eventually was known as the Vietnam War. This is the war of my generation. I might add that I am a civilian. It's my distinct honor and pleasure to work with the veterans on the Committee on Memorials and Remembrance, which sponsored this bill through the help of Vice Chair Esquivel. Over 58,000 American families became Vietnam War Gold Star families. 39 of them lost not one, but two sons to the Vietnam War. Four of these families resided in Oregon. During the last legislative session, the Wright family of Boring was appropriately honored for the loss of their two sons in Vietnam. Today, we wish to start the process to honor the Rowden family of Jackson County. The Rowden family's story is unique. Within weeks of the death of their second son, their third son received a draft notice. According to newspaper articles, the draft board was eventually convinced to rescind that notice. It has been said that the offices of Governor Tom McCall and Senator Wayne Morris were involved. Unfortunately, as it has been noted, Mr. and Mrs. Harvey Rowden, her name was Grace, are deceased. Their third son, Douglas Rowden, is also deceased, and the fourth son, Malcolm, resides in the Central Point area. We're not certain as to their whereabouts, but at the time of his death, the oldest son, James Rowden, was married with two children. With this said, we hope to see the remaining family honored for the extreme and ultimate sacrifice of Marine Private James Herbert Rowden and Marine Private First Class John Wayne Rowden. James succumbed to hostile enemy fire on March 5th, 1966 in Vietnam. John succumbed to hostile enemy fire on February 10th, 1968 in Vietnam. We ask that this resolution be passed to the House floor with a do-adopt recommendation so that we can honor the Rowden family. This resolution, when passed, will enable the process for signage and the dedication of a state highway in Jackson County as a Fallen Hero Memorial Highway in memory of Marine Private James Herbert Rowden and Marine Private First Class John Wayne Rowden. We make this motion because these were two heroes that were brothers. They sacrificed their American dream so that we could live ours. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Any questions for Mr. Bates?
I have no question. I just wanted to let people know that I grew up with Doug Rod. He's the one, the brother that they came to get. And the parents fought that all the way and got the help of our government, our state government, to stop them from taking the third son. And Doug, unfortunately, passed away about 3 years ago. So very close to me was this situation here. The second boy, John Wayne Rowden, passed away in Tet of 68. That's where he was at. So he was in Vietnam and Tet. So anyway, thank you very much, Mr. Bates. I appreciate your work, and we have two more to go.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bates, for making the trip today. There are no other witnesses on the list today. If I see no other witnesses, we're going to close the public hearing. The public hearing is closed on HCR 3. We open a work session. We're going to open a work session. And is there a motion on HCR 3, Representative Esquivel?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move HCR 3 to the floor with the do adopt and be adopted recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves adoption of HCR 3. Is there any further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, I'd like to call a roll call vote, please.
Representative Lively.
Aye.
Representative Meek.
Aye.
Representative Parrish.
Aye.
Representative Post.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone.
Excused.
Vice Chair Esquivel.
Aye.
Chair Evans.
Aye. Unanimous vote, the motion passes. I'd like to assign Representative Esquivel, if you'll do
the honor. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Be honored.
Thank you very much. That concludes our business for the day. Thank you for sitting through the first of the House Vets and Emergency Preparedness Committee. Truly want to make sure that everybody that cannot see the audience right now knows that we still have a pretty full House at the end of a committee. And looking forward to the ongoing conversations, and just thank you for all that you've done so far. Committee members, any final comments before we... Yes, sir, go ahead.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for everyone's information, on our Vietnam Wall, we are selling bricks at $100 a piece with people's names on it. I'm going to buy one for each of the Rowden boys because of what they gave up.
All right. We'll end on that note. The committee is adjourned for the day. The committee is adjourned for the day. Note the...